Islamic Revolution Inspiring Africa.
We are back again as we analyze how the Islamic Revolution in Iran inspired and continues to inspire freedom movements across Africa. Now, a popular Islamic awakening movement, also known as the Arab Spring, swept across the Arab world from early 2011. Tunisia in North Africa was the cradle of this movement that touched off a chain of uprisings across many Arab nations. Well, there is no doubt that this popular awakening drew inspiration from Iran's Islamic Revolution. Mr. Husseini, in your opinion, how did Iran's Islamic Revolution inspire the Islamic Awakening or the Arab Spring, which started off in Tunisia?
From that time, the Arab world realized that we cannot trust our leaders. And they were waiting for a spark. And that spark started from Tunisia and then went to Egypt and went to other countries. And all of these were under the effect of Islamic Revolution, who was calling for the decline of Israel and the demolition of Islam, the apartheid regime in Israel. So in this way, they have been in the same way that the Hamas was inspired by the Islamic Revolution, the same way that Hezbollah in Lebanon has been inspired by the Iranian Revolution. They did manage to get rid of the Israelis from Lebanon. The people of region also, they have realized that they have power and they are able to deal with their regimes.
Thanks for that, Mr. Husseini. Indeed, power is in the hands of the people. Now, in your opinion, what are some of the weaknesses that made the Islamic Awakening movement in North Africa fail to fully replicate the success of Iran's Islamic Revolution?
Well, that is also something to be discussed because, in fact, the Arab Spring didn't start from Tunisia. The Arab Spring was highlighted there. But the Arab Spring actually started when Mohamed Morsi of Egypt, after him becoming victorious in an election in Egypt, he didn't close his relationship with the Israelis, and they wrote a letter to the president of Israel asking him, calling him my esteemed friend, and assure him of continuation of relationship between Egypt and Israel. From that time, the Arab world realized that we cannot trust our leaders. And they were waiting for a spark. And that spark started from Tunisia and then went to Egypt and went to other countries.
Let's move on to West Africa, where Iran's Islamic Revolution has inspired millions of people in this region, which has a rich and ancient Islamic civilization. The Islamic Movement of Nigeria is a popular organization led by Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, currently being detained by authorities since 2015. In late 2015, Nigerian forces brutally attacked Zakzaki's residence in the city of Zaria in Kaduna State and the followers of the peaceful Muslim movement that he leads. In one of his speeches, Sheikh Zakzaki expounded on some of the reasons that led to the success of Imam Khomeini's movement.
Soviet Union collapsed because of it. It was based on false narration. What do you think of what you may call Western ideology, capitalism? Will it survive? Is it based on true narration? Narration of the reality of things. The reason why Imam succeeded is he has based his teachings on true narration of what is truth. True teach is message of Almighty Allah to entire mankind through his messenger.
Now we are joined by Suhaila Zakzaki, the daughter of the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Thanks a lot for your time. Now, the leader of the Islamic movement, Sheikh Zakzaki, has also been called Africa's Imam Khomeini. Can you tell us how Iran's Islamic Revolution and its leader, Imam Khomeini, inspired Sheikh Zakzaki?
First of all, I believe that, you know, the Islamic Revolution of Iran has inspired my father greatly in so many ways. I recall him telling a story of how his first introduction to who Imam Khomeini was, which he told me was at a class. It was during a class that when he was in university, and someone was trying, one of their teachers was discussing the subject of influence versus power. And they were trying to explain how certain people might not hold power and have a lot of influence. And that particular teacher cited Imam Khomeini as an example. And he said that Imam Khomeini was like such, the story of Imam Khomeini, just as brief as it was in the class, was quite memorable. And so that was his first introduction to Imam Khomeini, when the discussion of his influence in Iran, well, around the time when, you know, he was being cracked down on by the previous Iranian government.
That's quite an interesting insight on how Imam Khomeini influenced Sheikh Zakzaki, who went on to form the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Thanks for that, Ms. Suhaila.
The victory of the Islamic Revolution gave impetus to the nascent Palestinian liberation movement. Palestinians have been struggling for decades to free their land from Israeli occupation, and African governments have been at the forefront of supporting Palestinian liberation. However, before 1979, the masses in Africa rarely participated in rallies to express their support for Palestine. Now, every year across Africa, masses come out massively to express solidarity with Palestinians during the International Quds Day. This day is a legacy of the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, who designated the day in solidarity with Palestinians.
Because of we coming from an apartheid situation, the world also did steps like this in support of us. And because of so many marches and BDS movements worldwide, we fought and we broke apartheid. It's important for us to show solidarity with Palestine, because an injustice to one person is injustice to everyone worldwide, and we cannot separate ourselves. We do not live isolated in a world. We cannot keep quiet in the face of injustice. So it's important for us to highlight this, to educate people and to expose what is happening.
Let's now move over to Bukangesa, a pro-Palestinian activist and political commentator based in Nairobi, Kenya. Thanks, sir, for your time. Now, African civil society groups have been organizing the masses to mark the annual International Quds Day in solidarity with Palestine. How did the Islamic Revolution inspire African masses to come out and publicly express support for Palestine?
African people have been, you know, historically been brutalized by colonial and now neo-colonial forces. They draw a lot of inspiration from the consistency in the foreign policy of Iranian people that has been pro-people. For example, we have seen the Iranian people showing their solidarity, the Iranian government showing their solidarity with the oppressed masses in Africa, particularly during the apartheid regime in South Africa. So it's indeed that we also see that the Iranian people have a clear and consistent and even independent policy that is pro-people, and that to us we see it as a big win for all the anti-imperialist and of course anti-Zionist forces that reside here in the global south and elsewhere in the world.
Very well put there by Bukangesa. Resisting Western imperialism is the only way for Africa to attain real independence. Now, as an African inspired by Iran's Islamic Revolution, what message do you have for the Iranian people?
You know, the Persian history that is anchored on the spirit of resistance that is continuing to inspire the Iranian people and to continue to refuse, you know, the policy of the thugs in Washington. So African people know this, and they know that to defeat the colonial forces, then it meant a protracted warfare. It was not, you know, a policy of surrender. So we want to pass revolutionary greetings to our Iranian brothers and sisters and tell them that they have the revolutionary credentials, they have anti-imperialism credentials, and even standing tall against the arrogance of the United States of America And particularly, we are very proud of the Iranian people winning trust across the board.
And just to add to what Mr. Angesa has said there, Iranians have had long and historical ties with the people of Africa for centuries, even before Western colonialists arrived in the continent. Back to you, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki. Now tell us, what lessons do you think can be learned from Iran's Islamic Revolution?
People looked at religion for the most part as something that was backward, as something that was potentially limiting people who adhered to it. And at the very least, even if it didn't limit people, it was only seen as more of a private thing between people and God, and that was it, and nothing more. So the Islamic Revolution of Iran did come and shatter those perceptions, and definitely showed that Islam can be something beyond that, and is something beyond that, in all its complexities. The fact that it managed to achieve an Islamic government, an Islamic Republic of Iran.
Thanks for that, Ms. Suhaila Zakzaki. Now, Mr. Husseini, you have the last word in our show today. As we know, Iran inspired the liberation movements in South Africa and Namibia. Now, 42 years after the Islamic Revolution, Iran is now a powerful country and has attained self-sufficiency in many sectors, despite crippling sanctions. What lessons can African countries learn from Iran in terms of relying on their own resources to attain desired development goals?
The African Union, the African countries must wake up. How long they allow the European and the Western countries to come and take their sources and don't share any of the wealth to the African people.
Well, you have it there. African people must rise and aspire to attain true economic independence for this great continent to prosper. Iran has and will always stand by the people of Africa in their quest for progress and true independence. With that, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. On behalf of my colleagues, it's goodbye for now and take care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN. Thank you.
الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Today, with the development of means of mass communication and numerous other technologies, corrupt powers and treacherous hands are capable of changing events and their content. They analyze them in the wrong way and misguide public opinion. In particular, future generations and those who were not present when the event took place, who did not see it up close, and who did not hear about it in times close to the event itself. Today, one of the important things that intelligence services do is that they follow the events and incidents occurring in the world and after that, they portray them the way they want them to be portrayed. But they do not do it directly. Rather, they do it with others' tongues and pens, with the articles and analysis of well-known personalities in the world, and with the numerous means available to them, including money and use of threats and temptations. Recently, I read a book written by an American writer. Actually, he compiled the book because different individuals were involved in its writing.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
It is about the domination of US intelligence organization known as the CIA over the main newspapers and magazines in the world. The essence of the book is about this matter. It explains how the CIA has interfered in the writings and statements of well-known writers and reputable magazines and how it has inculcated its own analysis into public opinion instead of the real analysis and how it has controlled their thoughts. Not only has the CIA done so in American press, but it has also done it in other countries such as European countries. The book mentions a well-known French publication and says that the CIA has done and written such and such things before. This is common practice in the world. By doing this, the CIA is actually inculcating its wrong and distorted analysis about different events into public opinion, thus misguiding people all over the world. This is dangerous that always exists.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah. second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has chosen economic themes for 13 consecutive Iranian calendar years. This approach has been based on a prudent and broad-minded goal to strengthen the pillars of national economy and turn Iran into an economic power not only in the region but in the world. The year 1387 was named the Year of Innovation and Prosperity, and the years following also got similar names. In the advent of the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, the leader named the current year as the Year of Leap in Production to give an impetus to the issue of production and further accelerate it to achieve the economic objectives already envisaged in the past years. We are going to dwell upon the issue in a series titled Second Phase of the Revolution, Leap in Production. Stay tuned, please. Experts believe that the continuation of the current course is not effective in the progress of production, and there should be more practical and scientific measure to correct the status quo and bring all existing capacities and capabilities to the scene. Industrial countries have gained successful experiences in the issue of leap in production. Countries like Japan, South Korea, and China have made great breakthroughs in the issue of production. Hence, they have reduced their distance with the advanced countries and even turned into the pioneers in some spheres of industry and technology. This great move, which has been dubbed as leap in production by the leader, enjoys specifications and prerequisites. Ayatollah Khamenei outlined the future course of the Islamic Revolution in his fully comprehensive statement known as the Second Step or Second Phase of the Revolution. He highlights in the statement that strengthening production and making economy resistant requires a jihadi resolve and motive and a belief in the principle of we can. Iran has gained precious experiences, especially during the 8-year Holy Defense, to implement huge projects. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has called on all producers and economic activists to take long strides in the course of progress of the country. Leap in production can be evaluated as a key strategy in the course of the second phase of the revolution. Moving in this course depends on many factors. One of these factors with a direct impact on strengthening the economy is the existence of rich resources and reserves in the country. As for the economy of resistance, the more a country manages to apply its endogenous capacities and uses the existing conditions in interaction with the economy of other countries, the more successful it will be. In view of this, leap in production should be carried out through simultaneous change of major economic plans and methods of production. These changes should be directed toward economic concepts, while moral and religious values are fully observed in economic affairs. Economic institutes cannot go through leap and major development unless the economic and commercial behaviors change proportionately. A strong economy requires proper growth and heeding all parameters of economic leap. the economy of Japan can be a role model in this field. The Japanese economy suffered fatal damages during the Second World War, but after the war, the country focused on production and achieved economic growth exponentially. After the Second World War, Japan banned the imports of commodities and products and empowered old workshops and industries to promote domestic production. Thus, after opening its doors to the outside world, it was able to compete with foreign products. Therefore, enjoying skillful workforce and specialized industrialists, Japan succeeded to build up modern industries in mid-19th century. Countries like India and Brazil, too, have used the strategy of replacement of imports by indigenous production to boost economy. Other countries like South Korea and Turkey have had an external approach and chose the strategy of exports. However, Iran, due to enjoying great generating capacities in the economic fields, needs the pattern of resistance economy. In other words, it needs fresh plans and native programming in various domains to attain the pinnacles of growth.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The debate.
The United Nations says Yemen is speeding towards the worst famine seen in decades due to years of war. UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock said 16 million people are going hungry across Yemen. This is while Yemen's Supreme Council for Management of Humanitarian Affairs says that Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Yemen's city of Ma'arib. On Thursday, Ansarullah deployed troops to the city of Ma'arib, which is a stronghold of loyalists of the former Yemeni government. The Daesh terrorist group has also openly confirmed that its members are fighting alongside Saudi-backed mercenaries against Yemen's army and popular forces in the province of Ma'arib. Well, the country has been devastated by a war waged by Saudi Arabia and its allies since March 2015. The kingdom has also imposed an all-out blockade that has hampered aid imports to Yemen.
The fighting is escalating in the city of Ma'arib, which is the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in the north of the war-torn country. On Thursday, the Ansarullah movement and allied army units ordered a wide deployment of troops to Ma'arib, saying the move is aimed at protecting Yemeni citizens. The deployment came as reports surfaced suggesting grave human rights violations by Riyadh loyalists. Yemen's Supreme Council for Management of Humanitarian Affairs said Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Ma'arib. The council said Saudi Arabia and its allies bear responsibility for endangering civilian lives. Meanwhile, the Saudi-led coalition has also redeployed troops to the region and increased airstrikes against Ansarullah positions there. The United Nations has urged warring sides to stop their offensive on Ma'arib and called for an immediate ceasefire.
The attack on Ma'arib must stop. It puts millions of civilians at risk, as Mark has been commenting this week, and especially with the fighting threatening to reach the camps for internally displaced persons.
The UN also warned about a looming famine in Yemen, which the world body said would be the worst on the planet in decades due to years of war. UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock said 16 million people are going hungry across Yemen, including 5 million who are just one step away from famine. The UN official also highlighted the high records of malnutrition rate among Yemeni people. Yemen has been devastated by the war waged by Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies and backed by the US and European countries, such as Britain and France in March 2015. The kingdom has conducted airstrikes on its southern impoverished neighbor almost on a daily basis. It has also imposed an all-out blockade that has hampered even humanitarian aid deliveries to Yemen. The new US administration has been making a fuss about ending the Saudi war on Yemen and ensuring that humanitarian aid reached the Yemeni people. Despite the claims, Washington has failed to take practical measures to push its major regional allies, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, to end their deadly war against their conflict-plagued Arab country.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Kim Sharif, joining us from the British capital, London. Also, we have Manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas El-Najem, joining us from Toronto. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Ms. Sharif in London. Yemen's Supreme Council of Humanitarian Affairs has reported that Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Yemen's city of Ma'arib, and that Saudi Arabia and its allies bear responsibility for endangering civilian lives. Talk to us more about that also. That condemnation has not been echoed by the likes of the UN or the United States. And also, if you may, tell us, why is the Ma'arib battle so vital right now?
Well, good evening to you, and thank you for the invite to join the debate. Basically, the background to what's happening in Ma'arib in particular is that the oil of Yemen was being stolen and continues to be stolen by the Western-backed Saudi coalition team and their mercenaries. And of course, the income from all that oil revenue was being diverted for the purchase of hotels, villas, and lots of other real estate properties in Cairo, in Istanbul, and even in London. I have seen evidence of that. Basically, what's happening is that the international community doesn't want the Yemen army and its popular committees to advance in Ma'arib because it stands to lose a great deal of oil revenue that it's stealing from Yemen today. I'm not just making this claim. This matter was being investigated by the French authorities, I believe, about a year ago. We revealed that about 4 years ago that Yemen oil was being stolen in favor of the Saudi-led coalition via the French oil giant Total. And I believe that investigation is still ongoing. And that's one of the reasons why they don't want the Yemen army to advance in Marib. That's one point. The second point is, as your reporter has just confirmed, the most dangerous terrorist groups in the world, in Yemen today, are fighting alongside Saudi-led coalition forces. I'm glad they have finally come out and confirmed this. This was confirmed by BBC report Safar Ahmed. This was confirmed by CNN, whereby American weapons are ending up in the hands of ACAP and Daesh. This has been confirmed by what we found when we regained Al Baida. We found nationalities from Chechnya, from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, from many other countries. All the known usual terrorists were there. Why? What are they doing in Al Baida? They were brought in there by the Saudi-led coalition. They don't have ground forces. Their ground forces consist of terrorist outfits such as Daesh and ACAP, as well as mercenaries they get from Sudan, Senegal, and elsewhere. That's the other reason. They want Yemen to continue to have terrorism problems so that it can give the right. Americans and their allies the right to come and attack Yemen, as they have been doing for the past 6 years. So we don't have terrorism in the past controlled by Sana'a government by comparison. You hold will that see thought. That Sana'a government is the only one that's fighting terrorism in Yemen today.
Ms. Sharif, hold that thought. Let's bring in our guest from Toronto, Mr. Firas Al-Najim. The United Nations says that Yemen is speeding towards the worst famine on the planet. Top UN officials have also warned that this massive famine could wipe out any fresh peace efforts. The UN humanitarian chief, Mark Lowcock, said 16 million people are going hungry across Yemen, yet we're still witnessing international inaction to relieve the suffering of the Yemeni people. Why has this war been dragged out for so long?
Well, you know, it's quite clear we want this war to keep dragging on and keep going because there's a plan behind it, and the U.S. and the British and the French are the ones giving all the logistical support to this war. Like, they're behind, and they have, some of the strongest power inside the United Nations. And it's up to them to delay this war. It's up to them to stop this war. It's up to them to put sanctions against Saudi Arabia. We know Saudi Arabia is one of the biggest human rights violators in the whole Middle Eastern region. We know that they are a monarchy, tribal, tyrannical regime that does not respect human rights whatsoever. They don't have any human rights organizations operating inside their country. We see what they do to their own civilians in their country. We see what they do to any opposition members inside their country. We see what they do to other countries when people stand up for their rights, such as Bahrain, and they intervened and they went there and they occupied that place as well. They've been committing massive amounts of human rights abuses and massacres, war crimes in Yemen. We've been seeing it now. We're going into 6 years of a war, right? And we know it's obviously an illegitimate war from the beginning because the Yemeni people rose up peacefully to change the system that's there. We've heard Mark speak before. We've heard Ban Ki-moon before, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, speaking about it's the worst famine, it's the worst humanitarian crisis. But what's been done? When has Saudi Arabia ever been and their coalition held accountable for all these human rights abuses and all these war crimes? Nothing. We hear it sometimes. One time there was a certain labeling of charges by the United Nations, and then they pulled back and retracted that because of some bullying, because of some bribing, because of some blackmail. I mean, this is what the United Nations today. Today, United Nations is a tool for certain countries, and they can exercise the plans that they want and the projects they want. And then before they said we'll pull out of the International Criminal Court, we won't even recognize them. We won't recognize the Human Rights Commission inside the United Nations. They said it was, it's not operating right, so we just pull out. So pretty much we don't even care about what's happening within human rights in the United Nations. So it's a very biased system. It's a very unfair system. And, Yemen is the worst humanitarian crisis. We see the pictures every day. We've seen the famine. We've seen the children dying. Where is humanity? That's the question. Where is all these countries that are still ongoing and justifying supplying arms deals? You know, Canada, one of the countries that I'm living in here, our government here is supplying the biggest arms deal to Saudi Arabia continuously, and it's continuing, even though they know what's happening in Yemen.
Okay.
You know, this hypocrisy must stop, you know, and we as you...
Let's cross over back to London. Kim Sharif, U.S. President Joe Biden announced an anti-U.S. support for the Saudi-led military offensive in Yemen, indicating that the new administration in Washington is planning a more active role in efforts to end the country's war and the crisis there. The question is, will Washington act on those comments? Because ending support doesn't mean that the war will just end.
Indeed. We have had nothing but total hypocrisy from the U.S. regime. I mean, Mr. Biden must be reminded that his administration was in charge when this aggression on Yemen was announced in Washington on 26 March 2015. And if it hadn't been for U.S.'s full backing, and I actually suspect a command to the Saudi-led coalition to put together this coalition and attack Yemen, this war wouldn't have started in the first place. There is no mandate from the UN to invite or to allow anyone to use force against Yemen. If it hadn't been for U.S. bullying and involvement, and as I said, I sincerely believe this is U.S.'s war. And this is Mr. Biden's attempt at trying to play the Mr. Nice diplomat now that they have failed miserably in occupying Yemen completely and colonizing it, which is what they wanted to do from the start. And now between Britain and the U.S., they're playing the good cop, the bad cop scenario on us, whereby Britain continues to supply weapons, but the U.S. will start to play the nice diplomat who is going to make every effort to stop. For God's sake, it's very straightforward. If he really is genuine about what he's saying, I put him to the test here by inviting Mr. Biden to go to the Security Council tomorrow and pass a resolution demanding forthwith cessation of hostilities against the state of Yemen by the Saudi-led coalition and forthwith lifting of the illegal blockade, and then I will believe him and trust him. But then meanwhile he continues to make these statements, look, we need to see action on the ground. We don't want empty statements, and good cop bad cop scenario won't work with us. Yes. Let's just face it, Saudi-led coalition have been defeated. They are using civilians as a human shield in Marib. Simply because they are terrified witless. Once Marib has returned to the sovereignty of the state of Yemen, that is basically the end of Saudi-led coalition. They will have no leg to stand in continuing their aggression against Yemen, which is why their Western backers are also making noises about Marib. They're saying all warring parties. What do you mean by all warring parties? This is an aggression by the U.S. Okay. and the U.K. through Saudi-led coalition.
Mr. Al-Najm, I saw you nodding there, reacting to the news of Joe Biden's comments that the U.S. wants to stop its support for the Saudi aggression. Yemen's Supreme Political Council back then said that Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. They want to see action also. Why should the Yemenis even trust Washington? In fact, just as Ms. Sharif just mentioned, in 2015, it was the Obama administration, along with Mr. Biden, that gave Riyadh the support in the first place.
Yes, that's very clear, obviously, that Obama sparked this war at his time, and this person, Biden, is on the same system and same team, and he's gonna be, when he's promoting for his campaign, he's gonna try to use all kinds of different, marketing tools to get into power, that he's gonna stop this and stop that. But, like, he came in right now, and we see now the war is intensifying in Marib and different areas. He could easily pull the plug on the Saudis and stop this war and stop the arms deal right ahead and adopt a resolution in the United Nations to stop the war, right? They got veto power inside the United Nations. So it's a very easy war. The Saudi regime itself is living on the oxygen tank of the American system and regime. So it's very quickly. The thing is, they just don't want resistance in the area. I would like to add to Kim's comment about how this is, it's also there to secure Israel. So it's a U.S.-Israeli war, pretty much. And it's there to secure the interest of securing Israel, because they know that Ansar Allah are part of the axis or the unity of the resistance groups in the Middle East. And this all sparked at the time of 1979, where Imam Khomeini did his revolution, and he fought the colonial powers that they want to control the area, all these, you know, Western countries that want to set up their bases and start wars and sell arms to these guys and plunder the resources of the region. And Ansarullah is part of that axis, and this is a very dangerous area because of Bab al-Mandab also. It's a water pathway that is needed for them to bring their ships and their, you know, dock all their planes on there, their fighter jets, and bring in all their supplies to support Israel and to support the control and the bases of the region. So this is their main danger. They don't want a strong government, a sovereign government, a legitimate government. What is Ansarullah? Ansarullah has other political factions that are all Yemeni, and they're people that were inside the country. They didn't come from outside. There's not one Iranian person inside Iran, except maybe the ambassador that just recently got in there. So this is a very big joke whenever they say the Iranians are behind this, the Iranians are running the show. Where is the Iranians? You have not captured one Iranian. Have you had one prisoner of war that's Iranian till now, so you can even show some kind of credibility or even justify or even make up a scenario? They haven't even been able to make up a scenario where they find some Iranians, you know, and do something like this. This shows that everything they're doing is illegitimate, it's fraudulent, it's all fake, and it's all evil. And, you know, the only way it's going to happen, I think, is by the Yemeni unity and their defense and their deterrence. Like, these guys are, you know, they're powerful. Like, you know, when Biden had to pull their name off the terrorist list, this shows how strong they are and how big of negotiators they're going to be in the future. So we believe that the Yemeni government, Ansarullah, and the Houthis are the victorious ones, and they will defeat all these coalitions.
Kim Sharif, we were talking about Joe Biden's campaign trail. On the campaign trail, Joe Biden said, and I quote, "We will in fact make the Saudis the pariah that they are, and they have to be held accountable for murdering children in Yemen." Well, the Saudis right now, they aren't even on the UN's child killer blacklist. What does that mean?
Well, it's quite right. I'm glad you make that quote, because these were quite a few of his quotes before the election. He made a mandate. He promised the people of the US that if he is voted into power, he will do these things. But so far, not so good. The one good thing he's done is obviously removing the designation that was quite irrational and frankly illegal and unworkable, because it's designating the entire Yemeni population as terrorists, which is impossible. The only terrorists in Yemen are those people working for them, ACAP and Daesh, as they have quite clearly made a statement yesterday confirming that. Joe Biden, I mean, I want to tell you about another important thing. He said he was going to care for children. What about women? Last couple of weeks, Saudi-led coalition mercenaries in Marib kidnapped 8 women, beaten them with their gun butts and pulled their hairs. One of them just gave birth 2 weeks earlier. They refused to let her take her child to breast. One of the 8 women was tortured to death, and 7 of them were sold on to Saudi regime. That is human trafficking in a worst case scenario in the middle of this war. These women have done nothing. They were mere internally displaced people living in tents and places like that. And so Joe Biden, just like many other Western politicians, they say something, but then in reality, they do completely the opposite. And they always find good excuses to get away from it. At the moment, so far, it sounds like he has avoided speaking to Bin Salman. He hasn't spoken to him, and he made statements that if he is to deal with the Saudi regime, he's going to be communicating with Salman directly, and good luck to him, and know how to manage Alzheimer's situations. I hope he does. So he needs to do more than just say, I'm not going to be on speaking terms with this man who stands accused of brutally murdering Khashoggi in breach of all kinds of laws, laws of the heavens and laws of the earth, and disrespect to other people's jurisdictions and so forth. Mm-hmm. So we need to see more from Mr. Biden. He's now past the stage of election sound bites. He's now in power. He needs to act as the real president, right, and do the right thing and go and pass that resolution at the UN Security Council and deal with Sana'a government directly in the usual diplomatic channels, okay, because he will find them the best partners in the war against terror.
One last question for Mr. Al-Najim in Toronto before we leave. The Daesh terrorist group has openly confirmed that its members are fighting alongside the Saudi-backed mercenaries in Marib. A lot of other data points in the direction that the Saudi-led coalition and its mercenaries and even Washington have been fighting alongside Takfiri terror outfits such as Daesh and Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Share with us your thoughts on that issue before we leave.
Well, I mean, it's nothing, shocking at all, because the Wahhabi state-sponsored doctrine of Saudi Arabia, that's their, that's what they are. They're the Wahhabi sect. And the Wahhabi sect is the doctrine that's a deviant, and that is an extremist doctrine that has, obviously is far away from the real Islam. And these people are working based on this doctrine right now, and they just don't have a government. So they're just, lawless people on the ground.
All right. We're fresh out of time of this program. Allow me to thank my guest, Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Ms. Kim Sharif, joining us from London. Also, thanks to manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Mr. Firas Al-Najim, speaking to us from Toronto. Also, special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.